At California Psychics, we know some people can't read the career warning signs, like your boss still not knowing your name.
You, Tina, Lisa, Sheila, whatever. Get that report to me by lunch, okay?
It's Carrie, ma'am?
Just get it done, Terry.
So talk to California Psychics and receive the career guidance you need. We only connect you with the very best, so guarantee if your reading isn't life-changing, it's free. California Psychics. Visit CaliforniaPsychics.com today for limited time offers.
I lived in a parking lot behind a Pizza Hut where I worked. At the time, even though I was the little boy whistling in the dark, subconsciously terrified, I thought I was shitting in tall cotton. I thought I had it made. The car was more than big enough for me to live in. I was showering at the school locker room. I don't even think they have PE or like, anyway, my football coach would give me grief all the time. He's like, Davis, you got to go home. Davis, you got to go home. And I'm like, Judge, or not Judge, that was later. I'm like, Coach, I'm not going home.
Welcome to Mentally a Badass, the podcast where we get real about mental health, mixing in some humor with honest conversation. I'm your host, Justine Rhodes, and whether we're laughing through the craziness or getting deep into the tough stuff, you're never in it alone. Every week, we hear from people across all walks of life, bringing their stories, wisdom, and a reminder that being a badass means embracing every part of the journey, the highs, the lows, and everything in between. Let's get into it. Hello, Paul. Welcome to the Mentally a Badass podcast. I'm so happy to have you today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. We have a lot to talk about today. As I was learning more about you, I was like, man, he's been through a lot. And one thing that kind of like caught my eye, and I'm really excited to get into that, is that you were homeless living in a car. And I've never spoke to somebody who actually like lives in the car. Like I hear about it, but like, I'm just like so curious about the like actual like living experience. So before we get into that, let's go deep into your path. We like to do that in the Mentally About Us episode. We like to get to know you as a person. So in your childhood, you did run away. Let's go into like how your childhood was. Like let's start there.
Well, it's funny because every child is going to have a perception of what their childhood was like, right? And my siblings, while they agree with the way we were raised and the way we grew up, I have found that I was probably more not the black sheep, the family black sheep, but what's called the scapegoat.
Uh-huh.
Because I talk back. I stood up for myself. I didn't take any shit. So yeah. Because of that, from a young child, I bore the brunt of my parents' shortcomings. I was neglected, abandoned, physically beat by both my parents. And, you know, it was the norm for me as the third child, as the scapegoat, because I didn't, like I said, I didn't take any shit. So my dad was very physically violent. My mother would beat me at times too, you know, and more for my mother, it was the neglect and the abandonment. And that's what would form, as you may well know, the trauma bonds, where a young child will still crave attention and affection and love, even from a parent that's emotionally unavailable and physically abusive.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my childhood home, really. Drug addiction, alcoholism. My mom was a drug addict and an alcoholic. My dad was very physical alcoholic. So my little sister refers to our childhood home as the shit show.
You know, that sounds very valid. It sounds like, you know, very chaotic, and especially since both of them were beating you and both of them had like drug problems. Did they stay together or
no,
did they were divorced?
Yeah, they divorced when I was 13 or 14.
Okay, yeah. I wanted to ask that because I was going to say, I feel like those two together is probably bringing out the worst in each other and not even realizing if you really think about it.
Right, right.
Yeah. I want to set the stage a little bit here. Where did you grow up? Like, where are you from?
Kansas City, Missouri.
And then I also just like thinking like generation-wise, like around what time frame? Because I know obviously like back then mental health was not spoken about. Was it like around the time where you can like hit your kid and like diapers won't come? Or diapers is not a thing?
Yeah, exactly. I remember going outside with blood on my shirts, on my clothes.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Did anyone help you or do anything? Or it was just like,
Yeah.
It is what it is.
Yep. Yep.
Oh my God.
Not accepted, but I would more say ignored and looked past. you know.
Yeah, my mom went through, you know, the same time frame generation. She was saying like you were, I think she said like you were seen but not heard. She would say that. And then when she would explain that to me, I'm like, in my generation, like as a millennial, like pretty much borderline millennial, close to Gen Z, it's like I can't even like imagine a world like that. I mean, growing up, I had a pretty chaotic household. Mm-hmm. My parents like didn't hit me. It would be more like them hitting something next to me. Mm-hmm. So we had like that household, but you know, I'm not gonna say, oh, it's good. Like, I mean, I grew up with a mother that I was like scared of, but she knew she told herself she's like never gonna hit me. Cause like both my parents were like had like the belt and everything. So, you know, I feel like, you know, each generation is getting better. I don't have any kids right now, so I can't say like, oh yeah, I don't do this because I don't plan on acting like what my mother did, but I mean, I'll get back to you when I have a kid. So let's talk about the day you ran away. So like, how old were you? When was like, you're like, I'm getting the hell out of here.
I know it's funny too, because I've written a memoir. So a lot of this stuff is fresh. The first time I ran away, I was 14. And that was also the last time my dad beat the shit out of me. He threw me down the basement steps and I'm like, I'm out of here. Well, again, as a child, 14, I stayed gone for a couple of weeks and I came back. And then my parents split that year. They got divorced. I stayed with mom so I could continue in the school I'd always gone to. And she got a two-bedroom apartment, a bedroom for her and a bedroom for my little sister. And I slept on the couch in the living room. And that didn't last very long. I turned 16 and I got my ear pierced for the first time. And when mom came home from work that day, she's like, take it out or get out. I packed up what I was living out. I was living out of my gym bag anyway. I packed up my gym bag and left. And that's when I was homeless before the term was even in our modern vernacular. I was 16 years old living in a 1976 Pontiac Granville.
Wow.
Which is a big car. It was.
I'm like not good with cars. Like you can tell me that and I'll be like, I don't know. I just, when I hear 1970, I just think of a car.
Yeah.
I was gonna make a joke and say like, oh, I was gonna think about it as like an old car with like no like car play or, but I can't make that joke because when I had my first car, we didn't have any of that. So I'm not that like young where it's like, oh wait. Like this is a little bit off topic, but I just want to throw this in there because it's really hilarious. But my niece, she's 10 years old and she has her own phone. And the only reason she does is just because my sister wants me to get in contact with her just in case, like, you know, scary stuff happening, like shootings and things like that. Like, it's mainly for that reason. She has her own iPhone. So I'll, like, text her. I found there was, like, an old video of me when I was, like, 14 years old. And it was, like, my webcam. And I posted it on Facebook. So I saw it, like you know, memories. And I sent her it. And I was, like, yeah. And I said to her, I was, like, oh, my God, I sound like I feel like our voices sound similar. And she was like, why is the quality so weird? She was like, wait, that's so weird. Like, why is it like that? It's like weird looking. I was like, oh, wow. I just felt really old right there.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so crazy. So going back to you living in a car, how did you survive? Like, did you have money for food? I think of that. I'd be hungry. Like where to go financially?
Well, I was working at a Pizza Hut, believe it or not. And last summer, I have three younger children here. My older children, my grandkids live in Kansas City with the majority of my family and my younger girls. My oldest now is 18 and the twins are 16. And it was either last summer or the summer before I took them to where I used to live in the parking lot. It's no longer a Pizza Hut, but I went behind the Pizza Hut and backed into where I used to live. And I lived in a parking lot behind a Pizza Hut where I worked. So food really wasn't a problem because I could accidentally mess up a pizza and then put it out back behind the restaurant and I was set. I really, at the time, even though I was the little boy whistling in the dark, subconsciously terrified, I thought I was shitting in tall cotton. I thought I had it made. The car was more than big enough for me to live in. I was showering at the school locker room. I don't even think they have PE or like a, anyway, and my football coach would give me grief all the time. He's like, David, you got to go home. David, you got to go home. And I'm like, Judge, or not judge. That was later. I'm like, coach, I'm not going
home. We'll get into that.
I'm like, coach, I'm not going home. And you know, the school district, I'm sure they were all aware that I was living on the streets. And they granted me a grace that I can never repay because they let me continue. And that was a vow I made to myself. I was going to graduate high school. And I did. But really, to your point, to your question, subconsciously, I'm sure I was terrified, but I really thought I had it made. I thought I was 10 foot tall and bulletproof. And, you know, that part of my life really was the beginning of the Lone Ranger mentality and attitude that I carried for a long time, because nobody needs to take care of me. I can take care of myself. Look, I'm doing it. I'm living in a 1976 Pontiac behind Pizza Hut on North Oak Trafficway, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense, especially with a 16-year-old brain. Like, mm-hmm. Our brains are still developing. And, like, I'm trying to remember what part of the brain where it's not, like, fully developed. It's, like, the part of the brain where you are – it's, like, fear and realizing that you can die any moment. Mm-hmm. And just kind of, like, just being real, like, the world and being realistic and being more aware of that. I'm trying to remember. I mean, I know our frontal lobe it's like the last thing that fully develops. Maybe it's that. I don't remember. Did your parents ever try to like look for you or try to get you back? Or they're just kind of like, do what you got to do. I don't care.
You know, that's an interesting point too, because I have no memories of them ever, ever checking on me.
Really?
I know they knew where I went to school, right? I don't remember Mom or dad ever showing up at the school. I know they both know where I worked, mm-hmm. But I have no memories of them ever checking up on me, ever.
Yeah, I can never like understand that. It's like you're literally your son's, like your person, your offspring. Like I can't, yeah. I personally cannot understand that. But then it's like your parents clearly... They have their own demons and they just have, of course, obviously no excuse. It's crazy, horrible what they did to you.
They did the best they could with the tools they had at the mm-hmm. time. You know, I love them. I always loved them. We, mm-hmm. even as a family, all four, my brother and my two sisters and I, we all got out of the shit show as soon as we could. Mm-hmm. At graduation from high school, we were all gone. Both my sisters got married. My brother joined the Navy. I joined the Navy after I graduated high school. But even with the childhood trauma and the emotional and or physical abuse, we loved our parents. You know, they were mom and dad. And it was kind of an unspoken truth or whatever. We never brought it up. We never rubbed their nose in it. I never said to dad, do you remember beating the shit out of me, beating me to a bloody pulp when I was 5 or 6 years old? You know, we just loved. I guess that's why we just loved them.
That's so interesting. That's so interesting for me to hear, because I go to my mom and I'm like, hey, do you remember that time you called me a mistake?
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And then she's like, that never happened. And I'll be like, yeah, because it was a random Tuesday for you or something like that. I guess it's just like a generational thing. And also like with social media, it's like an influence thing as well. Because like, you know, people talk about it and it's just a lot of education out there and it's just like different mindsets.
Absolutely.
But you know, that makes sense. And like, I'm pretty sure my mom never did that as with her parents and such, or she didn't really even have the opportunity to even like talk about that with them. So, you know, I always say to her, I'm like, I'm very like lucky that you're here. So like, and then eventually she did actually like not that long ago, apologize for everything. And that's like, and then since then, like, she's just been like healing and doing like so great. But kind of going aside from that, because we're here to talk about you, did you talk to your parents like after the whole like running away? Like, did you guys like get in touch again?
I don't think I had a physical conversation with my mother till after I got out of the Navy. So that would have been just about 10 years. I'm 16 to 26. I don't think I shared 10 spoken words with her in those 10 years. My dad and I kept in touch just because, really, again, out of all of us four siblings, dad and I were peas in a pod. And that may be why I suffered so much under his hands, because he saw so much of himself in me. But dad and I mean, after I got out of the Navy, we drank together. You know, we'd go to the bars. We never fought together, you know. in a bar fight or anything, not with each other, but, you know, we kind of reconciled in that way. We reconciled at the bar over beers, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. I mean, it definitely makes sense. Like, if you even like start drinking, just like it kind of makes you guys open up and be like, okay, yeah, let's reconcile. It's like no problem or whatever. Which leads me to my next question is like, when did your addiction start? Like, was it after the Navy?
No. Very much, you know, I'm very active in a 12-step program.
Mm-hmm.
In that 12-step program, there's numerous sayings and you know, I was an alcoholic from the first drink, and I know I was drinking alcoholically at 15 years old. That was prior to my mom asking me to leave permanently after I got my ear pierced. She'd kicked me out one other time because I was 15 and I had a 24-year-old girlfriend, and I was coming home smelling like sex and beer and drunk.
Wait, sorry. I'm so sorry. Can I back up for a second? You said you were 15 and she was 24?
Yeah.
Oh, hold on. Isn't it very illegal?
Yeah, today technically it would be called rape, and it probably was rape back then too.
Uh-huh.
And that's a valid point, Justine, because I have daughters now that the twins just turned 16, so they were 15, and I can't imagine them having sex, and I can't imagine a 24-year-old man seducing them. So yeah, I mean, again, at the time, I kind of wore it as a badge, you know, a badge of honor that, hey, look, I got this 24-year-old girlfriend and she's teaching me everything I know about women and buying me beer. So back to your point, I was drinking alcoholically 15 years old, no doubt about it.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I can understand like also the thought process. When you're a teenager and you're like have a relationship or like a sexual like relationship with someone older, you think like, I am so cool, right?
Yeah. Like, absolutely.
Yeah, when I was 15 years old, I didn't have sex with a 21-year-old, but like there was involvement.
Yeah.
And also you just like got in jail too. So I was like, oh wow, I'm so cool.
Yeah.
But now I don't even know what he went to jail for. I'm assuming maybe he got caught with weed. I don't think it was anything like super serious. I think by then I was like, okay, if you killed somebody or if you did anything like that, I'll be like, okay, like, no, right. That's not cool. But it probably was just weed, I think. But yeah, I remember thinking that. And I remember a night where he texted me and he was like, hey, I'm going to have a party at my apartment. Like, we're going to go to the liquor store and pick up this. And I was like, wow, I'm so cool. Like, I have someone older who like, thinks I'm cool is gonna we're gonna have access to go and get liquor. Like especially for like someone who I was like bullied and not really like a cool person. I was like, this is my chance.
Right.
And then it ended up being like could have been a really bad situation. But thankfully I had really good friends to get me out of it. But going back to your relationship, because I know that I'm gonna mention this. You did get someone pregnant, right?
Yeah, in high school, I was the junior varsity inside linebacker, and she was my first wife, was a cheerleader pom-pom girl, and got the shit beat out of me a lot by the seniors, because she was a senior and I was a sophomore, and the rest of the football team didn't take too kindly to me dating one of the cheerleaders. But yeah, I got her pregnant when I was 16, and my son was born when I was 17.
Okay, so now now we got to put all of that together, right? Because now I'm hearing these stories and like when I was like learning about it, I thought they were kind of like, okay, this happened and this happened. This no, now it's like everything's all together here. So let's talk about that. So you ran away when you were 16 and then you did get someone pregnant. So you had, and then she had
probably
the baby. So like,
Pontiac.
I'm sorry?
I probably got her pregnant in that Pontiac.
Wait, so she had the kid, right?
Yes, my son, correct.
Yes, your son. So how did you manage to, you know, raise and support a child at such a young age?
Well, I didn't, honestly. I ran.
Okay.
And we had no contact till after I joined the Navy and was active duty. And then I'd heard through the grapevine, through the family grapevine or friends grapevine that on my son's birth certificate where it said father, it was unknown.
Mm-hmm.
He had put an unknown in, and that was unacceptable to me. So I made the decision that I was going to be a father to my son, and my name was going to be on his birth certificate, and that meant I had to get married. So we did. We got married, and it was just tumultuous, and I'm very active in my addiction and gone for 6 to 8 months while I was active duty, you know, and it didn't last at all, and it shouldn't have. I was not a good father. I was not a good husband. I was a drug addict and alcoholic, just like my parents by that time in my life.
So what was the turning point? Because you were like, you said you were like this for like 23-year destruction. So like when was your like darkest moment? And you're like, okay, I don't want to be like my parents. I need to work on myself because this is not going to be my life.
That's kind of like you said, there's that 15-year time frame where I'm married to my high school sweetheart. We end up having another child, my oldest daughter. And I'm a husband and a father, but only in word. My addictions had me doing all the things that a husband shouldn't do and a father shouldn't do. And so rightfully so, she filed for divorce and divorced me and moved about as far away from me as she could from Kansas City. She moved to Oregon. My addictions really stepped up after when I was single, because let's go, right? I'm 26, yeah. 24 years old and just let's go. Mm-hmm. I got a job at the power plant. I'm making good money. I can afford the more expensive drugs and just living the life. And then one night at a bar, I met the love of my life and fell head over heels. And we were party buddies, but we were also madly, deeply, passionately in love with each other. And you know, there's a huge difference between love. Like, I love my family. I love cigars. I love good black hot coffee. And then there's being in love. And Doris and I were in love and just running the streets, right? And just having so much fun and traveling and drinking and drugging and parties and concerts and all of that stuff. And so my darkest point in my addiction was the night that I beat her and I put my hands on a woman the way that a man shouldn't, the way my father, that I saw my father do. So that night, the one and only time I've ever done that, the transformation was complete. I became my father, and it was earth-shattering and humiliating and just unacceptable to my core, mm-hmm. that I had done that to the woman I love most in the world. And so that's what prompted me to get into recovery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that totally makes sense. And honestly, kudos to you for realizing that, like, you know, at the end of the day, subconsciously, unless you know, your awareness and such, like you just mentioned, it happens a lot where we can, like, as we get older, we like turn into our parents.
Oh, yeah.
And even like little things, like I noticed that as I get older, there's certain things that I didn't understand, like interest wise, that I didn't understand why my dad, like, for example, like, I remember growing up and he just like loved the History Channel. And I was like, that's sure. So boring. Yeah, it's just like, these are like, just like little things, you know what I mean? Because I maybe think about it as a kid and a teenager, but like, it's so boring. Like, why are you like what is this old guy doing, you know? And then I was like, not that long ago, about a couple weeks ago, I was at a hotel, like just trying to find like a movie. Then the History Channel was on. I'm like, oh my God, the history of buffalo wings. And I was.
That's hilarious.
I was actually very intrigued. I'm like, and I literally watched them start to finish about knowing where buffalo wings came from, like how it started. And I'm like, and I text my family chat and I was like, I'm turning into my father. And then just also just like the ambition and just, you know, I've noticed certain qualities. I mean, some good and then some I'm not really too crazy about, where I feel like in my brain, I'm just like, why am I thinking like my father, like the way that I didn't agree with him. Like, oh, why would you, like, you know what I mean? Like, the different thought process. And the same thing for my mother as well. I'm like, it's like, I'm an adult and I'm realizing all these certain traits. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm feeling it. I'm starting to feel like I'm literally half my parents, like half my mother, half my father. And I kind of wonder, like, the scientific, like, aspect, because, you know, subconsciously we pick up things as kids. you know? And then, but now I'm like, under trying to understand the physiology, I can never pronounce that word. You know what, I'm talking about.
That word.
It's like one of those words. So it's like, I can't print. I don't know what it is. Physiology. Yes. Okay. The physiological, whatever. I'm so intrigued by that. I'm like, how does that even, it's like, it's also crazy too, being aware of it and just feeling like, oh, stop it. Stop, stop. Okay. So anyway, back to you. So you realize that, oh crap, I'm like turning into my parents. Like, I'm not doing it anymore. So let's talk about your, you know, your healing and your recovery. Like, what was that first step for you? Like,
oh boy.
What did you do?
Well, it was quite the bitter pill to swallow.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in a power plant, so I made good money. I had a roof over my head. I had groceries in the refrigerator. I had cars in the garage. All my bills were paid. How could I be a drug addict? How could I be an alcoholic? I go to work every day. So learning about, I went to treatment. I went to an outpatient treatment 3 days a week for 3 hours a night. I saw the truths of addiction and I knew it here, but I couldn't move it the greatest distance in the world. I couldn't move it to my heart for quite a while, but I stayed sober for some reason. Well, more so because I knew that if I ever drank again, there would be a chance that I would put my hands on my wife. So I was almost deathly afraid of alcohol for a while, even though there was nothing more that I wanted to do than to get drunk and chop lines. So the huge bitter pill of the realization that, holy shit, I'm a drug addict and I'm an alcoholic. And then learning all the truths of all of that. I mean, it was mind-blowing. It was humiliating. It was, I would come home for treatment. I called it the mind fucks. I couldn't get my mind around all of that. Yet, I stayed sober. And I just celebrated 24 years, January 29th of this year. So, it's been quite the journey. Did I answer your question? I think I may have got lost a little in the history.
You know, and that's a good thing because you really got deep into it and you're really thinking back at it. The first thing I want to say is congratulations, 24 years.
Thank you.
Wow. And that's not easy.
No.
That's not easy. And you are literally a beacon of hope for people who are experiencing alcoholism and being a drug addict, because at the end of the day, people become alcoholics and drug addicts because it's hard for people to deal with what's like inside. And with all like the abuse that you went through, like, even if it felt like it didn't mentally affect you, because, you know, it's a lot of people don't realize it, especially since it's not spoken about, you know, in your generation. It's like at the end of the day, and I read a lot of books about like trauma and like the body. And even if you're like in your head, like not like emotional about it, your body is reacting to it. Anytime you feel like, I mean, it's your list. I don't want to like, it's trying to like explain this properly. Anytime someone feels a discomfort when it comes to like emotional, they drown in like alcohol and drugs. So they don't want to feel it. They don't want to feel those bad emotions. And it's because, you know, I'm sure when you were growing up, if you were showing emotion, they would like beat you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I don't want to be like assuming things, but based off of this conversation. And so like you just talking about it and like just giving that hope, it's like, you know, even though it was 23 years of this, it's like there's still hope that you can get out of it. Like just because your brain was wired a certain way, like you're like literally your brain can like, they say reparent yourself. I don't think that's the right word in your situation, but like just rewiring your brain and just healing overall, you're not going to crave it, the drugs and the alcohol. Right.
It's the neuroplasticity that neurons,
yes,
that wire together, fire together.
Yes.
And so let's do a line. Let's have a drink. Let's get a beer. You know, you have to change those and say, let's say a prayer. Let's go to the gym. Let's call,
right,
somebody. So yeah, it's retraining. It's literally rewiring your brain.
Yeah. And I like how you explain that. It's kind of like certain triggers, right? It's like, okay, I'm feeling like this. what can I do to, what's that word, like, I'm not going to say pacify, but like, oh God, what is that word where it's like you're soothing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're soothing yourself, like those emotions. And instead of, let me go grab like a Heineken or whatever, let's go to the gym and just lift some weights and just like you feel good about yourself. And there's so many natural ways that you can do that. But especially in just the world that we live in and how alcohol, like just thinking about just marketing and capitalism and how it's like pushed in front of your face, it's like, it's, you know, it's hard to for people to stay away from that. It's because your brain is being influenced, like, okay, this is what, you know, it's being promoted in my face, where I feel like it should be more of the gym and healthy stuff. And it's starting to get there to an extent.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you ever heard of this. Have you heard of kava?
I don't think so.
Yeah, it's no one really knows about it much yet. I live in Florida, so like people in Florida, if you ask them, they'll know what it is, and because we're like in the tropical area. But it's pretty much like plant medicine at the end of the day.
Oh yeah, okay, kava, yeah.
Yeah, and it's pretty much like a natural Xanax. Mm-hmm. So it's great for people who have anxiety or need to want to be social, and it just like it hits certain spots of your brain that like alcohol would, but you don't get like a hangover, you're not like destroying your liver, and it's not addictive.
Right.
So yeah. And there's also like a whole sober movement going on right now as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is like a whole thing. I want to get into, because your wife battled with breast cancer. So how, like, when did this happen, and was this before or after you became sober?
Well, that's, you know, that's kind of God's sense of humor. Because in January of 2001 was the night that I put my hands on her.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm in treatment in February of 2001. And then in May of 2001, she was diagnosed with cancer. In hindsight, you can see all the dominoes falling into place where God's guiding me to Alcoholics Anonymous to get sober so that I can take care of her. So she was diagnosed in May and went through all of that, the horrendous, you know, the chemo, the mastectomy, the lymph node removal, you know, just it seemed like they were cutting on her over and over and over again. And then the next spring, she was getting a new boob. They went for the surgery to give her a new boob. And all the time, I mean, it wasn't about me. There wasn't anything about her cancer that was about me yet. I'm struggling to stay sober.
Mm-hmm.
And now I have to stay sober. Because,
yeah.
Right. I have to take care of my wife. I can't a guy high on cocaine and methamphetamine and drinking fifths of bourbon is going to be incapable of taking care of his wife. So there was that resentment as well that, damn it, now I can't drink and drug because I have to take care of my wife, even though I loved her desperately and would have traded places with her in a minute if I could have. So it was, you know, there's nothing unique and special about Paul Davis. There's very similar stories out there in the history of mankind. I'm not the first man ever to lose a wife to breast cancer and struggle with some other aspect in their life, like I was struggling with sobriety, but it sucked.
I'm sure.
My first 3 years of sobriety sucked. There wasn't anything about it. You know, there's one of the other catchphrases is keep coming back, it gets better. Well, fuck you very much. It's not getting better. My wife is at home dying and you want me to stay sober and you want me to do the next right thing, where I didn't know what the next right thing was. So I had, you know, like we're talking about, from 15 to 37, 22 years of doing whatever I wanted, however I wanted, and as much as I wanted, and thinking that that's the right way to live. And now you're telling me that those decades of living like that, not were wrong, right? Because right and wrong is relative, but it's certainly not the way God wanted me to be living. And I don't think God wants anybody to destroy their bodies with drugs and alcohol. And then there's the flip side of the coin. Does God really want people to have breast cancer and die a horrible death?
Mm-hmm.
Lots of unpacking there, you know, a lot of struggle, a lot of not knowing what the right thing to do was other than take care of my wife.
Yeah.
Huge learning curve. But like I said, bitter pill. That pill was stuck in my throat those first 2.5, 3 years of sobriety, really.
Yeah. And just what you were saying before is like when she was diagnosed, you're like, okay, well, obviously I can't be drinking or doing drugs or anything like that. I can't even imagine like those 3 years. Mm. But first off, I want to say like my condolences. I'm so sorry, you know, for your loss. But I do want to say, you know, I am proud of like who you became. I mean, I know I'm just meeting you right now.
Yeah.
But so far, it's based off your story. I'm like, you've literally have been through hell and back. I mean, I think that's the big obvious already. Like, I don't think I got to tell you and be like, oh, yeah, no, it's okay. Like, no, you went through hell and back and, you know, and you're going on podcasts and you're telling your story. You know, I think that's, you know, truly an amazing thing. And as we were, you know, you talk about God before, like that is God's work right there.
Thank you.
Yeah, it is. Like, and that's, you know, I truly do believe in that myself. And I know that because I'm going to get into God as well, because you put that God entered your world dramatically. So when did this happen? And were you religious at all growing up?
Well, we were the C&E Episcopalians, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Christmas and Easter Episcopalians. And then again, when we got to a certain age, there's no way, shape, or form my dad would ever be described as a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
So at a certain point, he told us we could go to church if we wanted to or stay home. So of course I chose to stay home.
Yeah.
Then kind of a back up just a little bit. The year before I got sober, my oldest daughter, I found out, was suicidal and self-mutilating. So mm-hmm. I flew to Oregon, didn't kidnap her because that would be federal kidnapping if I brought her across state lines. But
hey, was she a minor? Was she a minor?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I bald-faced lied to her mother and told her I was just taking her home for a visit. But I brought her home and filed for custody and was awarded custody. And so she, you know, I've got this, what was she, 14, 15-year-old daughter that's self-mutilating and suicidal. And to your question, for the first time in my life, I started praying. I knew there was this guy called God. And I remembered Sunday school, and so I would just literally say, hey, man, if you're out there, I got a shit show going on, and I could really use some help. And it was funny because I always prefaced it with, this is Paul Davis from Gladstone, Missouri, and I'd give him my street address, and I know there's probably a bunch of Paul Davises on this planet. So I want you to know I'm the one from Gladstone, Missouri with the self-mutilating suicidal thing. And I don't even know if you hear me. I don't even know if you're really there. But if you are, dude, I could use some help.
Yeah.
And see, again, these dominoes, these situations, these circumstances that God's bringing about in my life to get me sober. I was driving to work at the power plant one day, and you probably don't remember, but cell phones used to have an antenna. And so
did. Well, not like one that goes out like this.
Right. So I'm driving to work and I'm talking to Doris, my wife, and I notice that I'm merging into traffic. I'm turning my blinker on. I'm hanging up the phone call. And anyway, the conscious thought was that, holy crap, I'm doing 5 or 6 things at one time. And then that thought was immediately driven out by a voice, not my own. And it said, if you're but a man and you can do 5 or 6 things at once, what do you think I can, what do you think I'm capable of? And yes, Paul Davis, I am here. And yes, Paul Davis, I do hear you. And yes, Paul Davis, I will help you. Seriously, about wrecked my truck. I mean, I'm not kidding. I'm like, holy shit, who was that?
You wrecked your truck?
Yeah, because God talked to me out loud in my pickup and it scared the shit out of me.
Interesting. Like you physically heard?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And God, again, nothing special, nothing unique about Paul Davis, but there have been several times throughout my life where God has talked to me out loud, unequivocally, no question about it. So to your question, yes, I knew there was a God before I got sober. Mm-hmm. And then my relationship with him, of course, has changed over the years. But my true fellowship with my Creator started when I got into recovery. And I was taught how to begin that relationship with my Maker. Makes sense?
Well, I would say that the part where you heard him. But it does make sense. Like, when you hear your daughter is suicidal, mm-hmm. that is probably like one of the hardest moments, like as a father.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember, because I was pretty much your daughter at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And when my dad found out, he cried. And my dad like never cries.
Sure.
Like you'll never see him cry. Like he's one of those people that would not show his emotions. Like, you know, just how being brought up and then also just being a man and whatever. And so he also was shocked and didn't understand, and he just didn't get it at all. Like, he was blindsided pretty much. So it makes sense how you felt like at one of your darkest moments, like, how can this happen? Like, you know, I'm not going to say everybody, because I can't speak for everybody, but there's times where I'll be like at my darkest moments and to the point where I feel like I just don't want to be here anymore. And then I go to like, I don't want to be like that person that's like, okay, I go to God when my life's just crap, but I don't want to be that person. But I'm not going to also pretend that I'm perfect and I've been that person, but I'm not. I feel like I'm here trying to defend myself for literally no reason. But but I think my point is that I get it when it feels like that. But it's also like, now you have God in your life, and like, I guess just tell me your present life, like your relationship with him at this moment.
At this moment, you know, it's been a 24-year journey. He never promises us a rose garden. And my life certainly, as we talked about, hasn't been a rose garden. But my relationship has deepened. There's something that I was taught very early on from my first sponsor, that a man says his prayers in the morning and a man says his prayers at night. And in the morning you say, help me. And at night you say, thank you. And especially the 10-foot tall bulletproof Lone Ranger that I was when I came into recovery. He was emphatic that a guy like me had to humble himself in front of his Maker. So I was to say those prayers on my knees. And I still do. First, I don't get up. There's not a morning that I get up out of bed. I roll straight from bed to my knees and I say my prayers. And the last thing I do before I go to bed is say my prayers on my knees. And then I get into bed. And I very much consider God a friend and wants what's best for me, and is not the punishing hellfire and brimstone. And if you do this, you're going to go to hell. I don't believe that shit at all. Like I said earlier, there's no way, shape, or form my father was a Christian in any way, shape, or form. But I don't believe my father's in hell. I don't.
Mm-hmm.
My version of heaven is a lot like the reality of Alcoholics Anonymous. We welcome everyone. We exclude no one. Race, mm-hmm. creed, color, sexuality, financial status matters not. You are welcome. And that's kind of how I think heaven is, you know. That's my hope. The Apostle Paul talks about in one of his letters, and I don't know chapter verse, but he talks about the three levels of heaven. So maybe my dad's down here in the basement.
I've never heard that before, not gonna lie. The three levels. That's interesting. That's the first time I ever heard that.
Yeah. I can't remember what book it's in, but
he's in the first one.
Yeah, dad's down in the basement.
Oh my God, that's like so funny. You know, my mom says that, she's like, oh no, maybe my grandmother that said this, that hell is really like earth, like where we are. I think that's what my grandmother said, to my knowledge. And I'm like, that's like actually kind of funny, but also kind of, I guess, kind of true. But also I kind of feel like it can be both the way you look at life. Mm-hmm. I can't really get into that because I can go on a whole conversation about mindset, but that's like not for this
right
episode. But like with my belief that It just depends how you want to look at things, because there's a lot of good in this world as well. It's not just like everyone's horrible, or it's like, you know, people are not born horrible. You know, it's a lot of stuff that goes on in your life, and it's your choice if you want to help yourself or like be and just go like self-destruction, and you know. But you chose obviously a good route. You're here right now. You're talking about it. You mentioned you wrote a memoir, right? I didn't know you had one. So what's the name of it? Like,
well,
let
it's
us
not,
know.
It's not published yet.
That makes sense. Okay. I was like, did I miss something when I was like doing my research?
Yeah. I the title is Sometimes Darkness. And that's, I titled it that because there's a song by a rock band that says sometimes darkness can show you the light. And so when I started writing my book, that song just played through my head. And so I knew that sometimes darkness, and I've always called my depression and my homicidal and suicidal tendencies, I've always called that when I go dark, right? And there are times I've gone very, very dark. So hence the title, Sometimes Darkness. But I will be publishing, I'm going to give the traditional route probably till August of this year, and then I'm going to self-publish. Everyone that has read it has said that this is incredibly powerful and evocative and brave and raw and vulnerable. And oh my gosh, Paul Davis, you're going to help so many people with this book, because just like our talk right now, I lay it all out there, you know, and sadly, there are very few men that allow themselves to be vulnerable and allow conversations, open, honest conversations about their feelings and about the shit they've dealt with and about, you know, fighting the dragons within. And it's not so much that you win the victory over the dragons, but you know they're there. And that's part of who you are, right? I mean, like my addiction and my depression and my anxiety and my homicidal and suicidal tendencies are all dragons that I would say I've slain, yet they're still a part of me, and they make me who I am. They are a part of me. And they will always be there. And yet, I choose not to indulge them.
Yes. Makes sense? Mm-hmm.
Dr. Jordan Peterson talks about the most powerful man is the one who's capable of great violence, but chooses not to. And he's probably not the first guy to say that, but it really resonated with me because I know who I am. I know what I'm capable of. And I know my demons and my dragons and my darkness, and I'm comfortable with them. I know that's part of me and will always be a part of me. And I think it makes me a better man, to tell you the truth.
Yeah. No, it's true. It could have really like humbled you if you really think about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it makes you more compassionate, empathetic, you know, very caring, and it led you to writing a memoir.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which that's super exciting.
Yeah.
So to end this, I have one more question.
Sure.
For someone who's listening and they're struggling, they're battling their own storm, they feel lost in life, what is a piece of advice that you would give them?
There's always hope.
Yeah.
There's always hope. It doesn't matter who you reach out to. Just reach out to someone. It can be your conception of your own higher power. It could be your best friend. It could be a doctor, psychologist, psychiatrist. But you've got to talk about it, because mm-hmm. it gets so powerful up here, the stories, the shit we make up. But you verbalize it and it cuts the power in half.
Yeah.
And then you talk about it again and it gets smaller and smaller and smaller every time you talk about it. You know, we touched briefly about my wife's battle with breast cancer, and she died. She took her last breath and died in my arms. And mm-hmm. for years, I couldn't even say that. You know, it was so overwhelmingly powerful here and in my heart, too, that even to talk about her death just slayed me. I mean, I'd be blubbering in a pool of tears, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the more we get it out of here, the more we get it out of here and we talk about it, the less powerful it becomes. You know, I mean, I can call up, the mother of my older children, I'm sorry if this, or the mother of my younger children, it was a horror divorce. And she takes every opportunity still 9 years later to demean and hurt me and portray me as a monster in my children's life. And I triggered when I dropped my girls off this weekend and I pulled around a corner and I called four people. I called four people to talk about it. And driving home, I had a 20-minute conversation with a man, and he's like, "Well, Polly, today's a C-plus day." You know, he's a retired educator. He's like, "Maybe it's even a D, you know, C-minus or a D, but you're talking about it. You're doing the right thing." And that's hugely powerful. So if you're struggling, and nature can be incredibly healing too. Go to the beach. The waves can teach you how to breathe again.
Yeah.
Teach you how to breathe again. Go climb a mountain and stand in the middle of the woods and just scream.
Yes.
So many ways to heal rather than feel trapped.
Yeah, I actually did that once. I just like got in the car and just drove to the beach. One day, it was only an hour away. I was like, I have free will. Just
yeah.
Get into my car and just drive to the beach.
Heck
and
yeah.
It was very healing because I was going through like a lot of depression then. And yeah, I'm glad I did that. And that's really good advice. You know, if people have like, can even go hiking or just anything, like touch grass, guys.
Right.
Like I actually posted a funny reel where it's so with the brand, but it was me saying, "Guys, I have a very important mental health tip," right? And I said, "Touch grass, bitches."
Right. There you go. Yeah. Heck yeah. That's perfect.
Then it follows a meme saying, "Go ahead, touch it." And it was like,
that's adorable.
I felt like it was just, I obviously got to think of fun ways of delivering the message, but I was like, this is on brand. So, but it's true. Like, I sometimes walk outside and I'm just like, where's the grass? Like,
right.
Usually I go outside, I see a parking lot, and then like I go to like the pool and I was like, oh, there's tiles or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, guys, if you guys take away any of this, touch grass.
Right. Touch grass. Don't smoke it.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for taking your time to come on the podcast and share your story with us. I really appreciate you.
Yeah. Thank you, Justine, very much.